That man, Richard Branson, is at it again. The millionaire adventurer and boss of the Virgin Group is about to embark on his latest daring journey around the world in a balloon. Conditions permitting, Mr. Branson will take off in a couple of hours' time from Marrakesh in Morocco. Richard Branson had a go last year, but was foiled by the weather. I spoke by mobile phone to the flamboyant tycoon and asked him if he was feeling confident.
We've got a very good weather forecast looking ahead 5 days. The flight is likely to be about 20 days, so all we can hope for is at least to get a good start, and I think we will get a good start. Whether we'll succeed, obviously, we have no idea at this stage, but we're going to give it a very good shot. Up there, the winds are very, very strong. They get up to 300 miles an hour, but we're forecasting winds of about 150 to 200 miles an hour for quite a lot of the journey, and therefore we will have to, on occasions, to hold on for dear life. The balloon is enormous. It's twice the size of the Albert Hall in Britain. It would hold 5 jumbo jets inside it, so we're holding on to something which has got tremendous inertial power. We're in a small capsule. There are 3 of us. It will be quite cramped, but it will be a great adventure, so we're going to enjoy every minute of it.
And you're not doing this entirely by yourself, are you? Because you have competition.
There's an American team and a Swiss team who are both planning to try to beat us to it. You know, it's quite possible that none of us will succeed. It's not so much a race against each other as a race against the elements and the new technology to try to keep a balloon up in the air for that length of time. And the longest a balloon has actually ever been in the air is 3 days. We're trying to stretch that to 18, 20 days. We think we've cracked it. We're flying an experimental craft. We'll see whether we're correct or not.
What makes you do this? You're a rich man. You've got all sorts of other ways of getting your kicks, and yet you choose to spend 18 days at 30 to 40,000 feet flying around the world.
I love testing myself. I love challenges. I love being able to do something that has never been done before. I love learning about things I know little about. You know, when people went to the moon, there was no real benefits that came from that moon trip, but it was magnificent, and the whole world could see the magnificence of it. Going around the world in the balloon, in a sense, there's no immediate benefits from it, although we are doing tests on the ozone layer, etc. But from our point of view, we're challenging ourselves. You know, we're pushing technology forward, and we're having a wonderful life, so we wouldn't give it up for the world.
Richard Branson's big adventure. Still to come on Newsday, fresh allegations of human rights violations in Ogoniland, and why Jamaicans are less than delighted about all-inclusive holidays. A reminder of our top story, opposition supporters in Belgrade have turned celebrations for the Serbian Orthodox Christmas Eve into another day of protests against President Slobodan Milosevic. Defying a police ban on marches, tens of thousands of people, led by priests and opposition leaders, took part in a Christmas procession. A race is on to rescue 2 solo yachtsmen adrift in the wild, cold waters between Australia and Antarctica. A life raft has already been thrown to one of the 2, a Frenchman, who was seen clinging to his upturned boat. Less is known about the fate of the other, an Englishman whose capsized vessel has been seen in the same area. It's hoped that he's safe inside. I spoke to Captain Raiden Gates of the Australian Navy, whose vessel is heading for the stricken yachts. What kind of conditions were they facing?
The conditions have just been updated by the Royal Australian Air Force P3C Orion that is down there on task, and unfortunately they are not good. They're running on a 5-metre swell with strong winds gusting up to 60 knots, but my more concern is the fact that the temperature is down at around zero. Water temperature is just a bit higher than that, about 5 degrees, but with a wind chill factor, as you would appreciate up there in the northern hemisphere, conditions are going to be worse.
And how long is it, do you expect, before you are going to be within range to launch a rescue operation?
We expect to be down there on Thursday. We are now south of Cape Leeuwin, heading south. Being right down at 52 degrees south, that's the most distance that we've ever attempted a rescue from the Australian station. So it's a long, long way away. At the moment, it's 2,600 kilometres away, or 1,400 nautical miles. So Thursday is the earliest that I'm going to be in a position to do any sort of operation.
How optimistic are you that you are going to find survivors when you get there?
The fact that the Air Force have dropped a survivor's raft, their special survivor rafts, to the survivor that we've found, that he's managed to get into that raft, And I'm assuming that he's sailing those waters, he'll be in his own immersion suit. So I'm reasonably optimistic that he will be still alive when I can get down there. I'll be working through the Maritime Rescue Coordination Centre once we get down there to see, for example, if the second person maybe, hopefully, is inside the overturned yacht, and that's the Englishman, Tony Bellamore, I understand. We may have to look at some sort of operation there of trying to get inside the yacht. Obviously, that's going to be very testing for us in those conditions.
Tell me, when you reach the point at which you can send the helicopters out, talk us through the operation that would then ensue.
Obviously, my concern with that, again, is the weather, and it's going to be everything down there, that far south, is weather-dependent. But what I'll be trying to do is launch the helicopter from approximately 100 miles. He'll fly to the life raft with the coordination of the P3C Orion above him. I'll winch down one air crewman who will wrench to the raft, recover the survivor with a double lift back from the raft up to the helicopter, then back on board, and I'm carrying a doctor, and we have the necessary medical equipment to deal with hypothermia. Hopefully that can all be achieved in something under 3 hours.
And that was Captain Raiden Gates of the Australian Navy. The Geneva-based World Council of Churches, or WCC, has issued a report which claims that Nigerian soldiers in the southeastern region of Ogoniland are committing acts of intimidation, rape, torture and shooting. In 1995, 9 Ogoni activists, including the writer Ken Sarawiwa, were executed in the face of strong international protests. Deborah Robinson went to Ogoniland to compile the report. She told me what she'd found there.
I was able to see the immense devastation from the oil spills and just the whole oil production. We were able to see the military, heavy military presence throughout Ogoniland. We were also able to see the roads that Shell has claimed that they have built, but we see that they just go to their installations and that the Ogoni farmers don't really need these roads, and Ogoni people do not have cars. Therefore, the report talks about all of these issues, but the report, Ogoni, the struggle continues, is much more than that. We talk more, we place the Ogoni crisis in the context of Nigeria and the human rights violations in Nigeria.
How easy was it to get this material? Did you have to go around in a clandestine manner? Did you get any cooperation from the authorities?
Well, I really don't want to talk too much about that, but I should say I did not go as an invited guest of the Nigerian government. And I know Shell has taken journalists in and flown them around. I wasn't a part of a Shell visit, so we used contacts to get in.
And the government, have they had a chance to rebut these charges?
I'm not sure if we really will hear from the government. I think the Nigerian military dictatorship is not so responsive and concerned so much about international pressure, given their reaction to the Commonwealth. Even in light of international pressures and pleas for clemency, they went ahead and executed the Ogoni Nine. I think the report will be of interest to many of the NGOs and many of our member churches. This is published by the World Council of Churches. Many of our member churches are very involved and very concerned about the situation in Nigeria, and we feel it will be a resource.
What kind of action are you calling for? What do you want to see governments and companies doing?
To the Nigerian government, we are calling for the release of the Ogoni 19, who are facing a similar special tribunal that the Ogoni 9 faced. We're asking that they abandon the illegitimate transition program and ensure a speedy return to civilian democratic rule, unhindered by the military. I think in relationship with Shell, we ask that they clean up all oil spills and allow an independent international body of experts to periodically assess cleanup activities.
Deborah Robinson of the World Council of Churches. Now, an all-inclusive holiday in the Caribbean might sound like a wonderful idea for the tourist. You go to a resort where everything, accommodation, food, drinks, entertainment, yes, even tips, is included in the price. But for local people on these paradise islands, the words all-inclusive spell disappointment. With the tourist season at its peak, many visitors don't spend anything locally. As Malcolm Brabant reports from Jamaica, that's causing a lot of resentment.
It's another world outside the guarded, sealed-off compound at Don's River Falls in northern Jamaica that houses the grand and beautifully manicured, all-inclusive, couples-only resort owned by the Sandals Company. There are wooden shacks, children in rags and bare feet, and people like Roy Daniel, who has few, if any, takers for his beachside horse riding business.
When it was Eden Toe, things was much better. Right, for the guests, them would come out, right, and they would ride with us and all those things. But from it inclusive, right, when you talk to a guest over there, they say, oh no, the people them tell you not to come out here and do those things, don't go nowhere with you. Like we are hooligan, right, like we're going to heat the people, so we don't get no guests at all to come here.
Although the company says guests are encouraged to leave, the subliminal message seems to be don't. Newlyweds Simone Barker and Matthew Woodham.
We didn't like the idea of being fenced in.
No.
When we went down the beach, we saw the fence. And
found that very difficult.
People
very
at
weird.
The fence watching you, and we didn't like that. We asked if we could go the other side, what would happen from one of the staff here. And he said we could venture out there, but
just don't wander off.
We would be hassled.
Knees up now. Left knee up on the right knee. Left knee up on the right knee.
Meanwhile, back in the pool, some float on airbeds sipping cocktails, while the more energetic take part in water aerobics. Don's River Falls is a long way in distance and character from the third world shanty towns of Kingston, the capital of Jamaica and one of the murder capitals of the world. According to Western diplomats, the all-inclusive resorts are helping to counter the island's violent image as a gangster's paradise. Ask about the profits of Sandals, the region's biggest all-inclusive company, with 10 resorts in the Caribbean, and all you'll get is a wry smile. But director David Roper insists that the company does nothing but good in providing large-scale employment and pumping 65% of every tourist dollar spent back into the Jamaican economy.
The spin-off effects are huge. It's not only direct tourism employment, but you have other entities like agriculture. Take Jamaica, for example. Jamaica's agriculture industry has grown significantly as all-inclusives have increased. Why? Because there's greater demand, because of the larger numbers, for produce.
In other countries like Egypt, which earn millions in foreign currency from tourism, murderous radical groups have sprung up because the benefits have not trickled down to the poor. Redundant horseback guide Roy Daniel says similar rumblings are taking place in Jamaica.
I cannot send my kids to school. So I don't have no money, right? And look and see your kids growing up. You cannot go to school, right? You cannot find lunch money. You cannot buy shoes for him. What you going to think about, right? And know that the next man have all of it, right? This thing going to cause a revolution.
Roy Daniel ending that report from Malcolm Brabant. A final look at the news headlines. Opposition demonstrators in Serbia have marked the beginning of the Orthodox Christmas with a march through the capital. The president of South Korea has endorsed new labor laws, which have caused widespread strike action. And in the United States, Republican Party leaders have confirmed their support for the Speaker, Newt Gingrich. On the markets, the Dow Jones closed up 23 at 65.67. In Tokyo, the Nikkei is currently down 549 at 18.896. And the dollar is currently trading at 115.3 Japanese yen and one German mark, 55.8. That's it from Newsday. From me, Paul Adams. Goodbye.
Well, let me remind you, our next news here on BBC World Service is in a little over 30 minutes from now. We'll be having a 15-minute bulletin of world news and correspondence reports at 7 hours Greenwich Mean Time. And do stay with us now. Coming up in just a moment, Rosemary Hartle with this week's Omnibus. And don't forget, if you've just joined us, let me remind you, you're tuned to London and programmes in the world service of the BBC. At this time on Sunday, that's at 6.30 Greenwich Mean Time, you can hear the second play about Agamemnon's children. Written by the Athenian playwright Euripides over 1,000 years ago, Iphigenia in Tauris tells the tale of the eldest daughter of the Greek general Agamemnon, who was murdered by his wife on his return from the Trojan Wars. That's our play of the week at 6.30 Greenwich Mean Time on Sunday. And now on BBC World Service, in Omnibus, Rosemary Hartill watches the work of the Christian Medical College and Hospital at Vellore in southeast India, where a dedicated team of doctors try to provide a service available to even the poorest.
is what is called a stereotactic CT scan, and this is the patient's head in the center of the scan. The whiter part of the this image is the tumor, and the darker or the grayer areas are the brain, the normal brain. In this case, it's going to be the tumor that we want to get at. Not surgically, but using x-rays, deep x-rays, that is the linear accelerator.
Babies, singing students, and high-tech radio surgery. Just part of the rich mix of life at the Vellore Medical College Hospital, one of the finest in India and now owned and run by the Indian Christian churches. 99% of its annual budget of 400 million rupees, that's £8 million sterling, is earned by the hospital itself. Its range of services includes radio surgery from a linear accelerator, one of only two in India. Such state-of-the-art high-tech equipment, not to mention the enthusiastic singing students, would delight and astonish the hospital's founder, Ida Scudder, who began it all 96 years ago. Before her death in 1960, she told the story.
One evening, I was sitting alone in my room, reading, when I heard steps on the veranda, and soon a knock. I went to the door and saw a Brahmin gentleman. I asked him if I could do anything for him. "Oh, yes, Amma," he said, desperately. "I so need your help. My wife, only a young girl of 14, is dying in childbirth. The Baba women can do nothing for her. And Amma, she is such a lovely girl." "But," I replied, "I know nothing about childbirth. I cannot help you. But my father is a doctor, and I can bring him. He can save your little wife." Almost in horror, he raised his hands and bowed before me, saying, "No man can look upon my wife. If you cannot come, she must die."
Again and again, she urged him to allow her father to join her and so save the young wife, but to no avail.
He could not have a man deliver his wife's baby. My heart ached for him as with tears in his eyes he sobbed, "Then she must die. And oh, she is such a lovely girl." He left and I sat down at my desk feeling desperate.
The desperation made even worse when, incredibly, that same evening, two more husbands appealed for help she could not give. The director of the Vellore Hospital, Professor V.I. Martin, takes up the story.
Next day, there were three funerals in that town, which were these three girls that she was called to help. This was a great struggle for her, but she finally felt that God was calling her to come and be a doctor to help women in pregnancy and labor in India. She went back to America, graduated, and after some further training in obstetrics, came and started a small one-bedded clinic. From that small beginning in January 1900 has grown this very large teaching hospital, which is now spread over five different campuses, has got a main hospital with 1,350 beds. We consider that training others to work in the healing ministry is one of our commitments, and our total student body is about 1,400.
We are now at the entrance of the emergency department of the Christian Medical College and Hospital.
The consultant in charge is Dr. Suresh David.
On an average, we see about 60 patients every day. For example, you see a young girl over here, aged 11 years, who has come in totally unconscious, and we are thinking in terms of two conditions. One is an acute central nervous system infection like meningitis, or the possibility of a brain tumor, because she's been having convulsions more or less consistently, and she is now going for a CT scan and subsequently lumbar puncture, which is required to assess if there is an infection of the brain.
If a brain tumour were diagnosed, open brain surgery would be the most likely form of treatment for her. But another patient was too frail for such an operation. At his computer workstation, Dr. V. Rajshekhar was planning radiosurgical treatment for him. This attacks the tumour by focusing radiation onto it.
Okay, we can take off the distance markers. Can we start getting the coordinates now, please?
On the multicoloured computer screen, this tumour was all too clearly visible and critically close to the most vital area of the brain, the brain stem.
The yellow is the contour of the brain stem, and hugging it on the left side is the white spherical tumour, which has indented it very deeply. So now it's a challenge to us to treat the tumour, but doing as little harm as possible to the brainstem, which is just adjacent to it, is almost inseparable, very little separation between the two.
If the radiation does touch the brainstem, what's the likely consequence for the patient?
The patient may not wake up. All the cranial nerves, that is all these nerves that control his breathing, swallowing and so on, can get damaged.
But you're going to take that risk?
We're going to take the risk in the sense that we will make sure that the radiation to the brainstem is as minimal as possible, taking into consideration that the whole tumour gets adequately covered by the radiation. So it's a fine balancing act that we have to perform.
Technology had displayed the innermost region of a diseased brain. But I now wanted to meet the patient himself, a former teacher and farmer from Bihar. In the intensive care unit, he lay exhausted and thin, his head shaved and bolted into a head ring, a vital component in the treatment to come.
This is Mr. Kapil Dev Singh, 60-year-old gentleman from Bihar. He has come with mainly headache and impairment of vision over the past 6 months, and difficulty in chewing and difficulty in swallowing liquids and solids over the past 3 months, and loss of balance while sitting and while walking. So he has severe vertigo.
He's speaking to us. What does he say?
He wants to drink water.
All right. Well, the lights have just suddenly gone out here.
Yes.
What happens now?
There are alarms which go off for patients who are on ventilators, so that the nurses are warned that these ventilators have gone off, and then they take over so the patient continues to be ventilated manually, though now the machines having been turned off. So they will continue this till the emergency lights come on. So we do have an emergency backup. The whole hospital has, especially for the essential areas.
What about operations that are going on, though, where people are using high-tech equipment and...
Yes. Again, there will be an interruption in the monitoring and all the equipment for a few... Not even 2 minutes, actually. The things come on, like you've seen now, actually. The lights have come back on. This, I think, is the main supply, but even the emergency comes on within a minute, I think. This is something that you learn to live with when you're operating here and doing work in India.
Power cuts, heat, dust, and an approaching monsoon. Vellore is not the easiest place to run a hospital. But for the head of the neurosurgery department, Professor Matthew Chandy, coming to terms with such problems is the price of providing care for all in need.
It is possible here in India to design and run a hospital exactly as it is done in the UK or in the United States, because now technology is available. But this would mean that you are going to make medicine very, very expensive. And as you know, the aim is to include the poor and the marginalized for health care. So long as that is our aim, we have to keep costs low. Now, to do high-tech medicine in the environment that we are in, there are two ways to look at this. Either you say that we do not have the milieu or the environment to do any high-tech work, so forget about it. Just look after common medical problems. The other way to look at it is that if we wait years to go into a situation where you have well-controlled temperatures, humidity, electric supply, water supply, then our patients in this country will never be able to get the high-tech medicine that they deserve. So therefore, you have to go into high-tech medicine. You cannot be waiting for infrastructure to catch up to the high-tech medicine that you are trained in and that you are capable of delivering to the patients.
So you have to operate in an environment, basically, in which you are not very happy.
Yes. When you are in the developing world, you have to put up with various problems. but not get put out by it. The difficulty then is to match your end result with the end result when somebody is, say, operating in a developed country. Let me tell you that you can do it. The only thing is you have to work very much harder to achieve that. Very much harder to achieve that. Because otherwise, you can slip very much easier when your infrastructure is poor.
In terms of quality of care, we do not compromise. It may not look as glossy as it does elsewhere, but it is very, very functional.
So do you think people from the West sometimes have unrealistic ideas about general cleanliness of public areas and so on?
I wish we were able to achieve those norms. There is a trade-off here between and the minimal necessary on one side and the ideal on the other side, and the necessity to keep the patients in an environment in which they feel comfortable. The wards are not dirty. The wards are mopped and polished. But when you look at the ambience of the ward, it is very much like a village in India. The patient is on the bed, his wife or sister or daughter will be sitting by the bed, and quite often you find that they feel sleepy and they are sleeping under the bed. This would horrify a hospital administrator in the West. When I see that, I feel happy because I know that we are still being friendly to our patients.
And there's certainly a friendly atmosphere across at the eye department. I was taken round by the Professor of Ophthalmology, Dr. Ravi Thomas, and Dr. Annie Martai, who introduced me to one of her cataract patients. His wife was sitting on a floor mat by the bed.
55-year-old Mr. Shanmugam came in with pain, redness and watering of the right eye. What had actually happened to him was that his cataract had become mature and then went on to a hypermature stage. And then the capsule of the cataract ruptures, from which the protein inside leaks out, and then the pressure in the eye gets raised.
Would this have been very painful for him?
Yes, it was very painful because the pressures were extremely high.
So he really came pretty late, just because he had relatively good vision in the other eye. He's got a cataract in the other eye. He can't see half as well as you or me. Mm. You see that grayish area?
Yes.
With a shadow, when I throw the light, there's a shadow there?
Yes.
So that's a cataract. And this is nera paringa, sir, konje. Following the surgery, you can see the reflection inside the eye. That's the lens in there. What you see there is the air bubble, which will absorb in a couple of days. Behind that, you can see a reflection from the torchlight inside the eye.
Yes.
Moving around, that's the lens, reflection of the lens.
Tell us about where he comes from and about his background.
Unga oor enge, sir? He comes from Katpadi, which is about 7 to 8 kilometers from here. He works in a tea shop at the railway station in Katpadi. That's our railway station. And he gets 21 rupees a day as his salary,
which is about 40 pence. How is he able to maintain himself here while he is not working?
The owner of the tea shop, that is his employer, has given him 400 rupees. And his expenses in the hospital have to be borne by him. He has pawned his wife's earrings to pay the bill.
Does he have to repay the money to his employer?
Ninga unga tea kadakaran na 400 rupa kuduthadu adu thirupi kudukanuma eppadi sambalathinu pidichiduma
sambalathuvanga
it'll be deducted from his salary.
So it's merely an advance?
Yes, it's merely an advance. And his bill will come up to about 3,500 to 4,000 rupees because of the three surgeries that he has had. It's a cataract surgery, intraocular lens and trabeculectomy. But because he has expressed these problems, we have asked him to pay only 1,000 rupees and the rest will be given by the PTP scheme, that's a patient-to-patient scheme. He says he has no children.
No.
And nobody to look after him.
How can he save that much money when his salary is so small?
So he says he has no children. They are the only, him and his wife, and their daily expenses come up to about 10 rupees, 11 rupees. So he's able to save about 10 rupees a day, with which he hopes to repay his debts.
The patient determines the level at which he pays by the level of comfort and convenience he wants. those who have enough for their needs are willing to provide for services which will then care for those who do not have. And what they pay is what subsidizes the poor and the needy. And this philosophy is really what keeps the institution going.
So, for instance?
Suppose they were to have a gallbladder operation. The rich man in the air-conditioned single room would be paying probably 30,000 rupees for the operation. The villager in the general ward, if he pays the full bill that is presented to him, will be paying about 5,000 rupees. But the doctor who looks after him has the freedom and the right to decide, no, I will charge this man only 2,000, or no, he deserves completely free patient and I will give it free. And I, as the director, do not question the judgment of the doctor, because I haven't seen either of the two patients. I see the bills that are paid and the bills that are written off. But this is a very major responsibility which our doctors, with the help of the nursing staff, make in their decision.
After our conversation with Mr. Shanmugam, Dr. Thomas further reduced his bill to a token 100 rupees. Judging a patient's true financial status is often tricky.
Well, I had this young mother. I didn't know her, but this child had come in with bilateral cataracts and needed surgery, which is fairly complicated, in both eyes. And this involves general anesthesia and a fairly stiff charge, if the patient can pay. And 2 weeks after surgery, when the child was due to go home, an old lady in tattered clothes brought this child to me and said, bill potter karange, which means they put a bill. And I said, what do you want? They said, I can't pay. But she was in a torn sari and she really looked like she couldn't pay anything. And the child was very small. And I said, fine, if she can't pay, she can't pay. So I was signing the bill off when the doctor who was looking after the patient walked in. And he says, hey, what's going on? And I said, this lady obviously can't pay, so I'm signing off the bill. He said, but this lady is nothing, no one related to the child. The mother standing outside, and she's all decked in gold and with watch and everything else. She's paid this lady 5 rupees to come in and request a concession. And then followed a chase with this lady trying to give the mother her child back and the mother pretending as though she doesn't know who the child is. So it becomes very difficult to judge, and I'm sure in some cases patients overstress themselves because we have made an error in judgment. But as I said, the principle is, the guiding principle is that no one should go away for lack of money to pay for the treatment.
Back in the brain surgery unit, Mr. Kapildev Singh was now lying alone in a bare white concrete bunker under constant supervision on television monitors. The tumour on his brain was about to be treated by radiation beams focused onto the diseased area through the white rotating arm of a linear accelerator. From the safety of the control room, I watched with Dr. Faith Rangad, radiation oncologist.
The patient is on the treatment couch, and now we are going to exercise the beams that we had chosen for the treatment. And from here we can activate the machine to rotate around the patient and give the first of the arcs that we have planned.
It must be rather unnerving being apparently abandoned in there, because you all come out and leave him.
In fact, that was all of us went up and told him that we were going to leave him by himself and that the machine was going to rotate around him, but that we'd be watching him from here. And before we accept them for the treatment, we talk to them as much as possible. This man was not a very good candidate for explaining to, because he was too ill yesterday. Today he's much better, so I spoke to him just before he went inside and told him that it was going to be like this.
Does he understand what's happening now?
He knows that he's getting a radiation.
So how long is each burst?
It varies depending on the dose that we want to give. And this particular one has taken 2.3 minutes.
The machine, recently donated from America, was valued at about £400,000. Suppose the treatment had not been available, what would have happened to Mr. Kapildev Singh then?
He would have probably gone on to become totally quadriplegic, that is, lost the use of all four limbs and probably become unconscious and would have been bedridden in a few months' time. So hopefully with this treatment it would arrest the growth of the tumour and prevent that from happening, so that he could lead a useful life for a few more years, if not longer than that.
Shekhar, ninge solungirla endha idhe epo vand idhe epo aarambichu
A far more common affliction in India is rampant gastroenteritis. It's estimated that 1.5 million children under the age of 5 still die of it each year. The professor of gastroenterology at Vellore is George Kurian. In a room off the general ward, lay a patient suffering from that once dreaded disease, cholera.
He says that on Sunday night, he felt there was a lot of fluid in his stomach and he started purging and vomiting. And when he came here, he was quite sick, so they had to put an IV cannula and start him on a drip. Now, this used to be the treatment of choice in the old days when cholera was rampant all over the country, putting in IV cannulas and having fluid infused. But since 1979-80, when they discovered the oral rehydration solution, the need for that is much less. The oral rehydration solution consists of a solution containing salt, sugar, and water. And using that, they have actually reduced mortality in epidemics from 30% to 3%. It's an ordinary, very small solution. Now, it doesn't prevent the diarrhea from occurring, but it rehydrates a person while they've started.
Now, to people in the West, the word cholera has some pretty frightening connotations. Yes. But do you feel confident about curing this man and most of the cases you have?
Oh, yes. It's quite easy to treat them once we've diagnosed the case. It's quite easy to handle all these patients. If you catch them early enough, you can treat them quite confidently. And most of them would survive. In fact, that's not really the problem. It's when they come late, when they're very sick, with kidney failure, when you have problems handling them. But otherwise, it's quite a treatable condition.
How often would you see cholera cases?
We see them in waves. Right now, we're getting an epidemic of cases. We get at least one or two a day, which is quite big. And obviously, this reflects much bigger numbers in the villages from where they come from. But listening to people who've had experience in cholera in the past, these numbers are minuscule compared to what they used to have. You had whole villages dying of cholera. It doesn't happen anymore.
Are there any particular conditions where cholera is more likely to flourish than others?
If you live in the sort of situation and the sanitation situation in India where water supplies are often contaminated by refuse, then you're more likely to get it in that sort of situation.
Now, as we came in, the sister was a bit worried about contamination.
Right. Yes.
Why?
Because
contamination of whom?
That's right. She was worried about your equipment getting contaminated. That's probably a little overreaction. What is really worrisome is when water gets contaminated by fecal contact and things like that. One of the patients we looked after upstairs had his mother looking after him, and 2 days later she was down with cholera. So it's by looking after him and contaminating her fingers, she's obviously ingested the bug herself. She's developed cholera herself.
So we're not going to get cholera now?
No, I don't think so. If you're careful with your water, you're quite all right.
Despite the professor's assurances, I was glad to beat a retreat. I was very careful indeed to drink only boiled water. But villages in rural India are not always able to take such care. One department of the hospital is dedicated to prevention rather than cure. It's the Community Health and Development Centre, known as CHAD, run by Dr. Abraham Jacob.
I would say the programme began with Aunt Ida herself, because even when she started the hospital way back in 1900, she felt that there was a need to take service from the hospital out into the community. And so she started having roadside clinics, starting with a bullock cart, going out every day, coming back in the evening with a team, later moved on to a van and then a bus. And so what we are now doing, I would say, is a continuation of the same concept, because 80% of our people still live in rural areas, and that's where most of the need is.
Despite the advances since the bullock cart days, huge challenges remain. For many women, childbirth is still perilous, as Dr. Lakshmi Seshadri, Professor of Obstetrics and Gynaecology, knows all too well.
There is no blood available anywhere other than in big hospitals. And bleeding is one of the most leading causes of death here. It can be bleeding because of abortion, tubal pregnancy, or at the time of normal delivery, after delivery, whatever. You know, there are breech presentation or a baby lying across, whatever. You know, it is just not picked up. Patient goes on laboring in the house. And then, you know, finally it can even lead to things like rupture of the uterus. The other important problem here is a blood pressure. The high blood pressure that occurs just in pregnancy. This, when untreated, can lead on to fits. Patient just has convulsions, and then if this is not treated immediately, you know, there can be bleed in the brain and they can go into coma and it can actually lead to their death. Now, many of these women do not have an antenatal checkup. The blood pressure keeps going up, they don't come to know about it, and then it's only picked up when the woman throws convulsions. And then the transport. By the time they get some kind of transport and bring them here, even now, there are remote villages where transport facilities are really not available. Or at least they would have had 4 or 5 convulsions by the time they come here. And mortality because of this was pretty high until recently.
It was to tackle these and other problems that Chad has now trained local people as health workers. They teach basic health care, act as the hospital's eyes and ears, refer serious problems, and step in an emergency. Kupu is one such health worker. She described with real enthusiasm and pride how her training in midwifery had helped her cope with the kind of emergency situation that all those years ago had baffled the youthful Ida Scudder, a difficult breech delivery.
அந்தளவுக்கு நாங்கள் வந்து தலையை பட்டக்ஸ் கழட்டிட்டு உடனே பின்பக்கம்
The feet was coming. I got scared. But still, what was taught to me in the training program helped me to remember what I should do. So I held the feet and I put the buttocks and feet over the mother's abdomen. And this helped me to get the baby's head out easily without much difficulty for the mother, for the baby, alas to me also. As soon as the baby came out, I was expecting the baby to cry and breathe. But the baby was breathing a little slowly, didn't cry, didn't know what to do. But still, I thought, I know, I am trained, so I should do something. So I picked up the baby, the head down, and I was holding the feet and slowly patted the back of the baby. Then baby started to take a deep breath, and I just slowly helped the baby to be wrapped up well, so that the baby kept warm, and removed all the secretions from the mouth, cleaned the eyes, then the baby started crying. I was so happy to hear the cry of the baby.
Kupu's commitment to her work paralleled the dedication of those working in the main hospital. Specialists such as Professor Martin and Professor Chandy could earn a month's salary in a day's private practice elsewhere in India, never mind the USA or Canada. But they and their students, with their songs of praise, prefer to carry forward the vision of their founder, Ida Scudder herself.
We need those who can take up the torch of life and carry on and make Vellore Medical College one of the outstanding medical institutions today, and shall I say, in the world. We need your love and prayers and help as never before.
Omnibus was presented by Rosemary Hartill and produced by Roger Femby. That programme was first broadcast in 1995. In 15 minutes in this week's multi-track session, Rick Wakeman is joined live in the studio by sisters Karen and Shelley Poole, best known as Alicia's Attic. That's a multi-track session after World News. This is London.
7 hours, Greenwich Mean Time. BBC World Service, the news with Guy Francis. Thousands more workers have gone on strike in South Korea following the president's announcement that the government is going ahead with new labor laws. Republican Party leaders in the United States say they're confident that Newt Gingrich will be re-elected as Speaker of the House of Representatives despite being charged with unethical behavior. And the man who ran East German intelligence for 30 years, Markus Wolf, goes on trial today on kidnapping charges. Thousands more workers have joined strikes in South Korea as the government made it clear it would press ahead with new labor laws. Hospital and broadcasting workers join the tens of thousands of shipbuilders and car makers already on strike, despite a call by the president, Kim Yong-sam, for peace between workers and management. Mr. Kim told a televised news conference that the new laws, which end the South Korean tradition of a job for life, were necessary to improve industrial competitiveness. From Seoul, Charles Scanlon reports.
President Kim gave no indication that he was prepared to compromise with striking workers who've succeeded in paralyzing key industries in protest against the new labor laws. In a televised news conference, he said the amendments were necessary and would help improve the country's competitiveness by creating a more flexible labor market. The ruling party forced through the new legislation 2 weeks ago in a secret session of the National Assembly. Union leaders responded by calling nationwide strikes against provisions that allow companies to lay off workers and to hire temporary staff to replace striking workers. The leader of South Korea's unofficial Federation of Trade Unions called for an intensification of the protest in response to President Kim's speech. Several thousand workers at hospitals and broadcast stations walked out on Tuesday. The car and shipbuilding industries have been hardest hit, with the government claiming $1.4 billion in losses since the industrial action began. Prosecutors have threatened to arrest union leaders who continue to defy summonses for questioning. In the past, the government has frequently resorted to force to break up strikes, but this time it may have underestimated the resolve of workers to fight back. There are reports that the government is now considering compromise measures to allay fears about mass dismissals. Some members of the ruling party were uneasy about the decision to force through the new laws in the first place, and there are fears that it could backfire on the government in the run-up to presidential elections at the end of this year.
Slicks of oil from a sunken Russian tanker are washing ashore along the northern coast of Japan, threatening marine and wildlife. A spokesman for the Japanese Maritime Safety Agency said the oil had covered one stretch of beach and was drifting towards the rocky Noto Peninsula. Another group of slicks has almost reached the port of Fukui. Stormy weather has prevented attempts by Japanese ships to disperse the oil with chemicals. The tanker was carrying 19,000 tons of oil to Kamchatka in the Russian Far East when it broke in half in the Sea of Japan last Thursday. Republican Party leaders in the United States say they're confident that Newt Gingrich will be re-elected Speaker of the House of Representatives later on Tuesday, despite charges that he violated ethics rules. After a closed meeting of Republican Party congressmen lasting more than 3 hours, the meeting's chairman, John Boehner, said there was no doubt that Mr. Gingrich would become the first Republican Speaker to be re-elected for nearly 70 years. Gavin Esler reports from Washington.
Last night, in a marathon meeting of Republican members of Congress behind closed doors, Mr. Gingrich defended himself against allegations that he diverted tax-exempt funds to further his own political career, then tried to cover it up when questioned by the Ethics Committee. Republican leaders predicted after the meeting that Mr. Gingrich will win today's vote, becoming the first Republican Speaker to be re-elected for 68 years. But the ethics inquiry will continue its work for another 2 weeks, and it is generally expected, even if he survives the vote, Mr. Gingrich will be considerably weakened. With President Clinton still being investigated over numerous alleged scandals, including Whitewater, the United States faces the prospect, unique in its history, of the leaders of its two elected branches of government, Congress and the presidency, facing serious ethical inquiries simultaneously. American commentators fear this inevitably will lead to weak government, though common suffering may encourage the two leaders to work together.
The American government plans to request the lifting of the immunity of a Georgian diplomat involved in a fatal car crash if a police report today says he's guilty of a criminal offence. A 16-year-old girl was killed in the five-car collision last Friday, and several people were injured. A member of the American Senate, Judd Gregg, asked President Clinton to withhold American aid to Georgia until the diplomat's immunity was lifted. If a request is made and Georgia refuses to lift the diplomat's immunity, the U.S. can only deport him. The Japanese Prime Minister, Ryotaro Hashimoto, has reiterated his desire to see a quick and peaceful solution to the hostage crisis in Peru. Speaking before leaving on an 8-day tour of Southeast Asia, Mr. Hashimoto said that he would not, as he put it, cave into terrorism and cancel his trip. He also expressed his full confidence in President Fukimori's efforts to resolve the crisis. 74 hostages remain in the Japanese ambassador's residence in Lima 3 weeks after they were captured by left-wing rebels of the Tupac Amaru revolutionary movement. This news comes to you in the World Service of the BBC. The man who recruited and controlled thousands of spies for East Germany during the Cold War, Marcus Wolf, goes on trial for a second time later on Tuesday. Mr. Wolf, the former head of the Stasi, the East German intelligence service, is due to appear in court in Dusseldorf, charged with kidnapping, coercion, and bodily harm. The accusations relate to three operations alleged to have been carried out by his agents between 1955 and 1962. Our correspondent in Berlin, Caroline Wyatt, reports.
For decades during the Cold War, Marcus Wolf was known as the man with no face. Despite his frequent intelligence coups, Western secret services had little clue as to his identity. But in his 30 years as head of East Germany's Foreign Intelligence Agency, Mr. Wolf was responsible for some of the greatest humiliations heaped upon his Western counterparts. One West German chancellor, Willy Brandt, was forced to resign after it was discovered that his personal advisor was a spy who reported directly to Mr. Wolf. At the height of the Cold War, Marcus Wolf controlled up to 20,000 agents and informants in the West, including at least one source at NATO headquarters. Mr. Wolf has already been put on trial once since German unification, but his jail sentence for treason was quashed by the High Court. It argued that as an East German citizen, Mr. Wolf could not have been guilty of betraying the West. For that reason, prosecutors have been careful to select three offences for this trial that were also crimes under East German law: kidnapping, coercion, and causing bodily harm. Mr. Wolf is accused of masterminding one kidnapping in 1955 in West Berlin, in which a young West German translator at the US High Commission was abducted together with her mother to East Berlin. Both women were returned to the West the following day after pretending to agree to spy for East Germany. Another charge relates to the kidnapping of a former Stasi agent from Austria in 1962 after he fled the Secret Service.
Opposition supporters in Belgrade turned celebrations for the Serbian Orthodox Christmas Eve into another round of protests against President Slobodan Milosevic. Defying a police ban on marches, tens of thousands of people, led by priests and opposition leaders, took part in a Christmas procession to the Cathedral of St. Sava. There, the head of the Serbian Orthodox Church, Patriarch Pavle, lit an oak branch symbolizing Christmas and gave greetings to the crowd before saying midnight mass. Our correspondent in Belgrade, John Devitt, watched the celebrations.
Church bells sound across Belgrade to mark the start of midnight mass and the beginning of the Orthodox Christmas. Fireworks are let off among the crowd of thousands standing in front of the city's main cathedral. Faces are picked out by the light of candles burning in the snow. And in a traditional custom, oak branches are set alight to celebrate Christmas. But the gathering was also a protest. Most of the crowd had marched from the city's central square, where they'd been demonstrating against President Milosevic, as they have for the last 7 weeks. The police, who on previous occasions had confined the protesters to the square, kept a low profile, and despite a ban on marches, allowed the procession through the streets. The opposition that recently won the backing of the Serbian Orthodox Church had calculated that the police wouldn't intervene. In a statement, they said that even during the time of the Turkish occupation, religious processions had been allowed. As the march was going on, an explosion was reported close to the offices of a political party led by Mirjana Marković, the wife of President Milosevic. The police quickly surrounded the area. The explosion caused slight damage, but no injuries.
The British Prime Minister John Major is travelling to the Netherlands later today for hurriedly arranged talks with the Dutch government on the future of the European Union. The Dutch have just taken over the rotating presidency of the EU and are trying to limit the potential disruption that may be caused by the forthcoming British general election. From The Hague, David Schuckman reports.
The Dutch take over the chair of the European Union at a highly sensitive time, with the British general election now assuming a pivotal role in European affairs. Talks on reforming the EU in the so-called Intergovernmental Conference are due to finish in June with whichever party is in power in Westminster. Dutch ministers who deny favouring Labour say that more important than the outcome of the election is to avoid a negative campaign which would end up limiting Britain's room for manoeuvre. In an effort to head off that threat, the Dutch have invited Mr. Major here to tackle the key obstacle in the talks, the issue of how countries which want to develop closer European ties can do so without being blocked by Britain. When the Dutch were last in the chair 5 years ago, they ushered in the controversial Treaty of Maastricht. They want the next treaty to be an ambitious step as well, but they know that political events in Britain may not allow it.
The United States Special Envoy to the Middle East, Dennis Ross, has continued his efforts to bring about an agreement between the Israeli and Palestinian leaders over Israeli troop redeployment in the West Bank town of Hebron. Mr. Ross expressed cautious optimism after a series of separate meetings with the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, and the Palestinian leader, Yasser Arafat. But discussions are continuing on the timing of troop withdrawals from other parts of the West Bank. From Jerusalem, Simon Ingram reports.
The US envoy Dennis Ross is shuttling back and forth between meetings with the Palestinian and Israeli leaders, attempting to close the last real difference, preventing them from concluding a deal on Hebron. At issue are the Israeli troop withdrawals from sections of the West Bank that would follow a Hebron redeployment. Mr. Arafat has been insisting that the three-part pullout should be complete by September this year, the date specified in the Oslo Accords. Mr. Netanyahu has strongly resisted this demand, saying he could set a date only for the first phase. Now, according to Israeli television, the Prime Minister is proposing to set March or April 1999 as the final date for redeployment. The television report, which has not been confirmed, said Mr. Netanyahu was pushing for the delay out of concern that any territory passed over to Palestinian control at this stage would be extremely hard, if not impossible, to recover during negotiations which have still to begin on the final status of West Bank land. It's certain that such a position will be firmly resisted by the Palestinians, and it's up to Mr. Ross to find a compromise.
The American entertainer Frank Sinatra has been readmitted to hospital in Los Angeles, but details of his condition have not been released. Mr. Sinatra, who's 81, went into hospital in November to be treated for what was described as a pinched nerve. He stayed for 8 days, and some reports suggested that he had developed pneumonia and had suffered a mild heart attack. Now, to end the news, here again are the main points. Hospital and broadcasting workers in South Korea have joined a strike by hundreds of thousands of employees after the government insisted that it would press ahead with new labor laws. President Kim Yong-sam says the laws are necessary to improve industrial competitiveness and has called for peace between the workers and management. Leaders of the United States Republican Party say they're sure that Newt Gingrich will be re-elected Speaker of the House of Representatives later today. The BBC Washington correspondent says Mr. Gingrich has lost status because of charges that he violated ethics rules. The former head of the East German intelligence service, Markus Wolf, goes on trial for a second time later today. He's been charged with involvement in kidnapping because of operations allegedly carried out by his agents during the Cold War. And tens of thousands of opposition supporters in Belgrade have defied a government ban on marches. They have taken part in a procession led by priests and opposition leaders to mark the Serbian Orthodox Christmas Eve. And that's the end of the news from London.